concept of where, you know, connecting with the spirits and from Aboriginal culture. And the Australian man said, you know, it's almost like a watch that's been, you know, in my family for generations, and I, you know, it's not even mine anymore. It belongs to my people. It's not mine to give you. And you always, you know, people are always asking me for the time, and white people want to come and take the watch. That's what it's like to take the whole culture and the ritual and the secrets and learn dream time. And he ended up by saying, get your own dream time. Which, although it wasn't the most friendly exchange, it was set my uncle and my second cousin off on this quest, which I think was a wonderful statement, get your own dream time, which I think is a calling for all of us. And so I brought this in as an example, and I'm not relating any sacred secrets of the innermost Ojibwe tradition. Some of you may be familiar with dream catchers. They're fairly common. And in fact, they're fairly recent. I think they might be 18th or 19th century, so it's not like a center sacred ritual of the Ojibwe. And they spread out from there to the Great Plains Indians, and throughout now they're sort of a pan-Indian symbol. And now they've become quite commercial. In fact, this one came in the mail with one of those charity flyers from the symbol. And I looked at it and said, made in China. So really interesting world. But rather than throw it out, I brought it in, and I thought it's a wonderful symbol. Because what the dream catcher is something that they put on a child's bed, and the good dreams, at least from what I've heard of the Ojibwe tradition, the good dreams come in through the centerfold here. And the bad dreams get caught in the outside, so that the child, it's a charm, so that the good dreams can get to the child. I've heard other versions of this where it's the other way around. I think in some versions in the Lakota people, we already have the good dreams, and the bad dreams go out through this hole, and the good dreams get caught in the net, so the good dreams stay with you to warm you up, you know, like honey, or just this thing that you can carry around with you. But either way, this acts as kind of a filter for good dreams, so that the good stuff in life can come through, and the bad stuff be kept out, and the good stuff be kept in, and the bad stuff go out through this hole. And I think this idea of a filter can be quite profound when we think about vision. Because I know, at least I think, that the fear for a lot of people when we talk about vision, they might say that we're talking about living a visionary life this year is, you know, who am I to put together a vision for life, right? I mean, how can I think 50 years or 100 years or 5 years in the future and, you know, to make up a vision, to have a blank piece of paper and say my vision for life is, some of you may just get that and go, but a lot of people, it's a lot more challenging. And one of the things that I think the dream catcher reminds us of is that vision is already out there. It's already out there. We just need to act as filters to let the good stuff in. Vision doesn't necessarily need to come from just within us. It's something that we just spontaneously create. We just need to let it. We talked last week about Jonah, and Jonah, God said to Jonah, you know, you're going to do this. And some of our visions might be like that. We might get a very clear picture of what we're going to do with our lives. Some people know exactly. And some of us don't. But I do submit to you that the universe can tell you things if you listen to it. Will tell you things. The universe will tell you things if you listen to it. And if you don't believe me, and I think you should test anything you hear. And what I invite you to do to test it is to go out in the wilderness for 3 days. Turn your cell phone off. Throw out your iPod. And just be there in the wilderness for 3 days. And I contend that at the end of the 3 days, the universe will tell you something. Now, it may tell you something very simple. It may tell you you need to get out there and be in the quiet of the wilderness more. It may tell you that nature is beautiful. These can be very simple things. The universe doesn't need to tell us a PhD statement. It can be something very, very simple, something even obvious, but something that we hear in a different way. It can even tell you that you don't like hiking. But it'll tell you that in a deeper way after 3 days than you knew after 5 minutes. So I think we need to open up and listen to the universe. And that's the first step of vision casting, creating a vision to our life, is creating a space for listening. In fact, I think it's the most important step, but I think the rest, if we do enough of that listening, will take care of itself. And I can't describe to you, because I don't know exactly how, the whole process of vision making happens, what the universe has to tell us gets turned into a vision for our lives. But I will say that what the universe has to tell us, it's telling us in a way that's motivating us to action. So we don't need to understand the whole process. And it can come from a long way away. For instance, your vision for your life could come, this is just an example, from your grandmother being taunted when she was a small girl. She could be walking down the street sometime in 1920-something, and feel, and somebody could taunt her, and it could wound her, it could get down right down to her bones. And she could resolve out of that. She's never going to treat anyone. And she could have this, you know, you've ever met somebody with that fierce caring, that just kind of, that's so loving, so compassionate, that's like fiercely compassionate. You know, they just look you in the eyes and they deeply care about you. And maybe you knew your grandmother, maybe you didn't even know that story, but you knew how your grandmother was, and you decided, you took a little bit of that on into your life, and maybe you became a caregiver, or your relationships were influenced by that. So the vision may come from way outside your own life, in your grandmother's life, in somebody that you, you know, on the other side of the world, for all you know. But the vision, if you let it in, will start to formulate inside. So I want to encourage you today to get this hole wide enough to let the good dreams in. And I think that is actually quite challenging. There's all kinds of ways you can do it. Meditation is a great way, just to be silent, being out in nature, being one with the arts, making art. Although I like the Keith Richards quote, he says he doesn't make art, he just is a lightning rod, and he's there and he picks it up and then he transmits it on. So he was pretty successful with that. So, you know, this idea that it's all just out there, we just need to find a way to accept it, to listen to it, and then to welcome it. And to keep out the stuff that's distracting us, which I'm going to do. And it doesn't have to be this quiet contemplation. You know, I'm a big fan of quiet contemplation, of taking some time to be quiet. But it can be in the story of somebody who had foster children, right? Which is not exactly as far from quiet contemplation as you can get. It's busy, it's exhausting, and it has the emotional component of, you know, he was saying, you know, his love sometimes isn't enough, and it's incredibly heartbreaking. And yet, even though that heartbreak is there, it's that love and that listening to the universe and his caring for his foster children that let him look outside the window and know how beautiful the world is, that paradise is right here. So it's the other side of that heartbreak and being open to that pain. So I think it's key that we do that, and I think it's hard that we do that. I think it's hard to open this hole big enough to listen to the universe. And I think it's hard, not because we're busy. I mean, I know we're busy. I know people have 2 jobs, 3 jobs, all kinds of stuff going on, family-ish, you know, everything goes on and it's busy. But I think it's more than that. I think it's because after all, right, meditation and television, meditation should be easier. You don't have to watch anything, you don't have to follow anything, you just have to sit there, right? If you're not comfortable, you can sit somewhere more comfortable. All you have to do is think. You don't even have to think. It's okay to just be. But many of us, how many of you find meditation hard? I find it hard. And I think part of that is not that we're busy, but because we're scared. We're scared of what might come in because it opens us to our pain, which we can often spend a long time not wanting to be there, present to our pain, and it opens us to vision, which is a scary thing, right? Because a vision, if we get this vision, if we listen, and there's a vision, and there's a call on that vision, and it requires us to do something, then we'll have to change who we are, it'll challenge us, it'll make us be someone different than we are, and we'll have to live a different way, and who has time for that? It's an incredibly scary thing. So I think when we're resistant, so whatever it is, and you probably already know what it is that opens up that hole for you, that connects you with the universe in a deeper way, that resistance is not so much busyness, it's our fear of that, the fullness of that, of the challenge of that. And so we kind of avoid it, we amuse ourselves to death, which is Neil Postman's phrase, and I think it's a skit. He was talking about American Life, and he wrote that in 1985, about new media. And we have all kinds of ways of amusing ourselves and distracting ourselves. And somebody in the first service said, you know, we even avoid joy, right? Joy can be really hard. We say, oh, wait, there's things I should be doing. And we avoid joy because joy is emotional and it's painful, and not painful, but it's full and it's hard sometimes. So even joy we'll avoid because we don't think we deserve it, whatever reason. So our whole emotional life, we can spend a long time avoiding it and just turning that dial on and doing anything to amuse ourselves, which is a way of just kind of avoiding the deeper emotions in life. You know, there's a lot of I always find new things in the Sermon on the Mount to amaze me. And there's one sentence that I just always skipped over because I thought it was so obvious, which is, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. See, I read that, you know, there's all this stuff about the peacemakers and blessed are the meek and all this amazing stuff, and I was like, yeah, okay, that's nice, right? You want people who mourn to be comforted, and you think that's good, there's nothing, you know, it's a nice sentiment. But I think it's actually kind of paradoxical in a way, because what Jesus is saying is, blessed are those who mourn, for they should be comforted. Well, if you want to be comfortable, the best way is just not to mourn, right? I mean, mourning is really painful. So it's almost this, to say blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted, I mean, wouldn't the easiest way just to be avoided? I mean, that's not much of a blessing, right? To say you're going to, you know, you start off comfortable, and then something terrible happens, and then you're comforted. It doesn't sound like much of a blessing. It sounds like just getting back to where you started. And in a way, it is. But for anyone who's been through mourning of anything, whether it's a person or a project in their life, there's more to it than that. You come back to the same place in a different way. And the paradoxical teaching, I think, is that this, if we're open to our pain and our hurt, the comfort can come in a different way. We can see our surroundings. The vision can be different. Our eyes can be opened to the beauty, to the paradise that's all around us. So there's another book I read this summer which gave me a lot of hope. I'm reading a lot of books about hope because we need it. Called Active Hope, and it's about the environmental crisis that we're facing. It's written by Joanna Macy and Chris Johnston, who's an active Buddhist practitioner, and he's a psychologist, psychotherapist. And what they say, you know, I shouldn't say everybody. So among many of us, there's this acknowledgement that the earth is in, we're kind of doing some stuff to the earth that isn't good in the long run, that will have ramifications, that having a giant, you know, huge amount of garbage in the Pacific Ocean, in our landfills, dredging the earth and strip mining the whole earth will have ramifications, and it's kind of, it's a painful thing. And there are those who deny that, of course. But there are also those who agree but don't want to engage. You sort of say, well, you know, I know it's terrible, and it's so depressing that I don't even want to think about it. Which is totally understandable, and I get that. But what the authors say is they say, like, we have this predisposition in a culture that if it's depressing, or if it drags you down, that you should just kind of, you should put it in the weather, right? And that you shouldn't put it through here. That you should just hold it off at arm's length. Which is not, it's certainly not, you know, when you're a child, this is fun, this is a child's thing, you don't want anything bad to happen to your child. And you want the good stuff to come in and all the bad stuff to come out. But for an adult, say an adult, a great place, Native America, going on a vision quest, it is not about avoiding all the, you know, not thinking about all the tough things in the world. And what Macy and Johnson say is that we need to honor our pain for the world. So to acknowledge, just thinking about environmental issues for a moment, acknowledge, yes, there's all these terrible things, and to acknowledge that it's our pain, because we're a part of the world, right? We may be a part of the problem as well, I know that, but rather than start with guilt, start with pain. Start with, you know, this world that we're in is imperfect and it's painful, and I hate that's happening. You know what I mean? If you start with that pain. And then they say, honoring our pain for the world as a call to adventure. So rather than just living in that pain and just staying there, it can be a call to adventure, which is kind of an exciting thing. We can live in a new way, and that instead of it being this this terrible looking forward to a hopeless future, it's an adventure. It's an unknown future. It's a future with a lot of unknown. But if we're willing to embrace that unknown, there's this sense of adventure. And they have a word, I just want to close with a word that they caution about. And the word is sacrifice. Now, sacrifice is a wonderful word. I mean, I'm a parent, so I know all about sacrifice. There are plenty of Friday nights I'd love to stay up with my buddies and play cards at 3 a.m., but I don't do that anymore. So there's sacrifice that gets involved. But I think when it comes to environmental issues or anything that we feel pain about, really, there's this sense of, we sort of say, well, we've got to roll up our sleeves and we've got to just plow forward, and it's this kind of, which I think is a good thing. And then there's this thought of like, well, you know, life won't be the same, but we just got to make the best of it. And that's okay, but actually it doesn't paint a full picture. I mean, parenthood, to give one example, is there's sacrifice involved. And it can be incredibly painful and difficult. It can be boring, I mean, it's so much misery. But it's an incredible way of life. It's not a sacrifice. It's opening up to life's beauty. It's absolutely an amazing new way of life. And I think we'll find with living into a new way of life environmentally that what we're being invited to do is to live in the fullness of life. Not to live a less than life. Even though we want to use less fossil fuels and less, recycle more. It's not a less than life. It's living in the fullness of life. And the more that we honor our pain and are aware of it and able to live with that vulnerability, the more full and rich our life is going to be. I can say that when I spoke to legislators about equal marriage and marriage for all people, it's not my favorite thing to do. I mean, I like legislators. I don't like going in there and doing my spiel. But I did it, and I had this kind of pushing through it. And then afterwards, when you're walking out, and you're like, wow, this happened, this conversation happened, and they listened, and they're thinking about it, and maybe they'll be on the right side of justice or history when the vote comes up again. And afterwards, when you're walking out, you're not feeling like, well, I just lost 2 hours of my day, even though technically it's correct. You're feeling like life is rich and full. And it's not about necessarily success, it's about that you're living in the midst of, you're willing to face those emotions and the fear and the feeling that, will it ever amount to anything. You're willing to be there, to be in the midst of the unknown. And then when you're there, and you're there with others, and you're open to it, and you're open to your own sense of unease, there's the sense of that you're living in the fullness of life. So it's up to you what you do with your own filters, what you do with your own dream catcher. But I want to invite you to make that space as wide as you can. Filter out some of the stuff that distracts you, the stuff that isn't really serving you in the long case. But allow some of that, the richness of life, the emotions of life, even the hard stuff. Because the more you let in, the more it'll transform into you, into vision for tomorrow, but also the fullness of life today.